Hi, this is Michael Manring, and you're listening to Acoustic Music Talk with Brad Apple.
Welcome to Acoustic Music Talk, where we explore the art of acoustic music and musicians, with your host, Brad Apple.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the Acoustic Music Talk podcast. I'm your host, Brad Apple. This week, I'm delighted to have as our special guest, Missy Raines. Missy is a fantastic bass player and has been in a number of great bands through the years, as well as leading her own bands. And she is a 9-time recipient of the IBMA Bass Player of the Year Award. Missy and I talked on the phone the other day, and I got to ask her a lot of questions about her bass playing style, her influences, and lots of other things. So let's go ahead and get into that interview with Missy. Well, thank you again, Missy, for joining us on the Acoustic Music Talk podcast. As I mentioned to you, you've been one of my favorite bass players for many years now, and it is a pleasure to have you on the show with us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and it's my pleasure to be here. I appreciate you asking me.
Yeah. Well, I was looking through some information about you. I knew a lot of it already, but I see that you have been playing the bass for many years now, and I was going to ask you about how you started, what got you drawn to the bass, acoustic bass, and kind of how you started out in music. Could you kind of go into that with us?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you know, I don't remember a time when I didn't know what bluegrass was, and other kinds of music as well. There was a lot of music being played in my house when I was growing up, but bluegrass specifically because I was taken to festivals and events and jams and concerts, you know, from the time I can remember. My parents were big enthusiasts, and they loved to listen to it. They didn't really play, so but they played it on the stereo at home and then sought it out in the world. So I remember, you know, I started playing piano, and I sort of that quickly switched to guitar, and then my dad decided somehow and somewhere that he wanted to pick up a bass and then be able to jam along with some of the jams that we were attending at the time. And so he just, I don't know the story. I wish I did, but I can't ask him because sadly he's gone. But he just brought this bass home and surprised us with it and said he was going to learn to play it. And of course, you know, I was very musical curious, and I was just a little kid, so I just picked up the bass, and I had enough guitar knowledge. I was able to have somebody show me, you know, how to play G, C, and D on the bass, and then I could follow the guitar chords. And I just really liked it when I started playing the bass. It was kind of this feels really good kind of moment.
Yeah, you were kind of drawn to the sound, sounds like there.
Yeah, there was something about the experience of playing it with everyone else. And some of that could have just been that literally within our circle, a small circle of neighbors and friends that we were jamming with, there hadn't been a bass up until that point. So
right.
It was a pretty novel thing, and you know, everyone was excited. I mean, by the first time we brought it to the jam, I mean, everyone played that bass by the end of the night, of course, but we got to take it home.
Yeah. Tell us some about the bass. I read a article in Strings magazine that came out here a couple of months ago, and it was talking about your bass. Could you elaborate on the bass you're playing right now?
Yeah, I'm fortunate to still have this bass. This is the one that my dad bought, and I'm quite sure that he didn't realize what a great instrument he bought at the time, because he just wouldn't have known. He wouldn't have had any way of knowing. But he stumbled upon this and bought it from a well-known musical family in West Virginia by the name of the Staggs family, and he. So it's a 1937 K bass, and K was an American company that was making instruments like this in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and and I say instruments like this, like they were sort of in heavy rotation, like putting out a lot of instruments for even to put in schools and that sort of thing, and for bands to carry on the road. And of course, at that time, when a band with a bass went on the road, the bass actually oftentimes did go on the roof. So they had to be sturdy and be able to stand up to stuff. So this bass is a plywood bass, but it has some features about it that's really special, like a three-piece neck. So it's got two solid pieces of curly maple on the neck with a solid piece of wood in between. It's got real purfling around the edges. Later in the 50s, late 50s or so, they switched to decals for the purfling. It's got beautifully engraved brass tuners. And so there's just a lot of things that's really sweet about it. This particular bass, the folks that I mentioned, the musical family that owned the bass, they had also kind of decorated it for stage. And by that I mean they'd actually like antiqued it with a dark brown stain and then painted black music notes on top of it. So there's four music notes on this bass. And so it looks very kind of rockabilly and rockabilly before its time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. I was going to ask you about that. I'm looking at the picture from the Strings magazine right now, and I see the music notes you're talking about there. So besides your K bass, I'm sure you probably have other basses. Do you have some other plywood basses or even a carved bass or two?
Yes, I do. I have a couple of other plywood basses, a King and another K bass. I have three. Three other basses, and they're all plywood. And then I have an upright traveling. It's not really an electric bass, but it is a small bodied bass called the Eminence, which so it's got sort of like almost like a fiddle size to it, but you put a pickup on it, and it can sound like a full bass, but you could travel with it. You can take the neck off of it and put it down, pack it into a golf travel bag, and it travels pretty easily. So I have one of those. I guess I have three or four basses right now.
Okay. Tell me this. What do you look for in a good bass? What makes a good bass to you, like when you pick one up?
Well, sound, of course, is going to be the ultimate. Yeah. But I kind of feel like you can get the sound to happen out of any decently made instrument, but what I really look for is the shape and the size of the neck, and how it feels in my hand. One of the things that's so beautiful about old K basses in general is like really old ones, like the late 30s and the mid-40s, up to mid-40s Ks, was they had an extremely small neck, and I really like that. Obviously, I'm very used to it. So I really like and look for how the bass feels in my hand, in my left hand. But then, of course, the sound, it's got to be well-made enough so that the sound is able to, release from the body of the instrument.
Right.
And in my case with like this old K, the wood is so thin and so dry because of its age and all that it's quite lovely and beautiful, but it's actually because of the stain that the previous owners put on it, that the dark brown stain, just because there's that substance is on the wood, it makes the sound kind of dark and warm. And I kind of like that. And sometimes you'll hear like much brighter basses. Well, my bass is definitely not a very bright bass, but I really like the warmth of it.
So do you like playing steel strings on your bass?
I do like steel strings, but I've used a lot of different kinds. Everything from gut strings, I used to use a brand called Golden Spirals, and they were sort of a nylon kind of string. But I do like the steel strings. They fit what I'm doing these days the best. Ultimately, you know, I would have all, like, each bass sort of set up a little differently so that I could, you know, if I just wanted a bass with the gut string sound, I would have that bass set up for that. And then one with the steel string and, you know, so forth. But yeah, I use the D'Addario strings. I've been using the D'Addario strings for many, many, many years. And I really, these days I've been using the Zyx string, which is a hybrid of a steel outer ring with a synthetic gut core, kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah. So I'm guessing, what applications would you use, say a gut stringed bass versus a steel string bass? What type of music would you differentiate between the two types of strings and tones?
Well, you know, you could do just about any gig on either of those, but the gut strings are going to lend themselves a little bit more easily to, like, being able to slap a lot more. The steel strings you can still slap, but they don't sound quite as good as a gut string sounds when you're slapping. So it just depends. If I was, honestly, you know, I'm so used to playing my steel strings these days that I can, I feel like I can, for the most part, like, really try to make the most out of those strings. In other words, give them that punch and that percussive edge that the gut string brings. You know, if you work really hard at it, you can get a pretty good replication of that out of the steel string.
Right. Okay. Well, talk to us some about your influences. I'm sure when you started on the bass many years ago, you had your influences and heroes at that time on acoustic bass, and probably through the years. Talk to us about some of the people that you've listened to and how that might have contributed to your style of bass playing.
Yeah, so, I mean, the first, my first memories of noticing the bass when I was a little kid on the stereo, of course, would have been the records that my mom played of the original Country Gentleman, which featured primarily at that time, the bass playing of Tom Gray. And, while I had been influenced by all kinds of bluegrass, it was the playing, Tom's playing, is very active walking lines and stuff on that Burly Gentleman, music that really, you know, interested me and excited me. And so I just tried to play, you know, like he did. And then, of course, by the time I really was actually playing, more, he was playing with the Seldom Scene, and I was getting to see the Seldom Scene in person. And so I got to see him on stage, and he was still sort of playing that kind of style, a very sort of, you know, busy kind of walking style underneath the rest of the music. Mm-hmm. And so I was really influenced by that. But there were a lot of things that happened around that time. Also, you know, I was very inspired and interested in the music that Tony Rice was making, and, you know, J.D. Crowe, the New Glass Revival, all those folks. But one of the main influences that came after that would have been Todd Phillips, almost completely because of the record Manzanita, which Tony Rice, was his record that came out in the late 70s, and that, the playing that Todd did on that record kind of, you know, changed my life. It's yeah. Not an overstatement. And then it goes on from there. I mean, there's, like, just tons of folks, through the music of Tony Rice. And at that time when he started to play, dog music, which was David Grisman's version of, you know, sort of acoustic jazz kind of thing. And through David Grisman's music. It led me to the door of jazz, and so I started listening to jazz players early on as well. And folks like Ron Carter and Dave Holland and folks like that early on. And, of course, you know, again, just tons of folks have contributed to, you know, my list of influences.
You mentioned Todd Phillips. He is a great one. I was listening to his released album here a few days ago. That's really some great stuff there.
Oh, yeah. He's just a great, he's a great musician overall. And
yeah.
I feel like the folks that excel, who are like really rounded musicians are the ones that, you know, tend to make some of the best music because, you know, they're not just good on their own instrument, but they've got a really great sense of what needs to happen everywhere. And that's why he's such a great producer.
Yeah. Let me ask you, you talked about jazz, and you're certainly adept at jazz. I've listened to a lot of your playing. As a bassist, how did you start getting into jazz? Did you just listen to records and try to at first copy what they were doing, or did you take formal study in some jazz too? Because it's pretty complicated stuff.
You know, I didn't study jazz at all, and I do not feel like I'm a jazz player in any way. I'm very influenced or inspired by that style of music, and I've listened to a lot of it, and I've played with other folks who are also had been influenced by those styles, and many folks who had actually studied the style way more than me. And so through that, I just kind of try to, you know, figure out what I could do to make it work. But I think it's just really just listening. But I've never formally trained at all. I don't have like a music degree, or I don't even really read music very well.
Okay.
Actually, I don't really read music anymore at all. I guess I did when I was 8 and I was playing piano, but uh-huh. All of that's gone. And so everything I do is pretty much by ear. But yeah, so I mean, I love jazz, and I play at it. I appreciate your words, but I don't really feel like I'm knowledgeable in that area.
Well, I feel like you do really great.
Well, thank you.
I was going to talk to you some about your awards as a bass player. You've won the IBMA Bass Player of the Year Award. Is it 8 times or 9 times now?
It's 9.
9, yeah, okay.
I'm always self-conscious when I have to correct someone and it's larger than the number that they said.
Well, you know, the reason I asked it that way is because I found one article that mentioned 8 and then another one that said 9. So I wasn't sure myself. So,
no problem.
Yeah. And you were the first, female bass player to win the award too, back in 1998. So that's really great.
I was just going to say, first of all, thank you. And, I was going to say that I have won that award in both centuries.
Yeah. Well, that is an accomplishment there. So there's so many great players in which you're definitely in one of the top of the pack there. So that is a great accomplishment. I wanted to talk to you some about the bands you've played with. You have played with a lot of people. And the one time I've got to see you was with the Claire Lynch Band. That was over in Bartlett, Tennessee around 2007. I think that's the only time I've seen you in person myself, unfortunately. But that was a really great show. And you've played with Claire. You've played with Jim Hurst. You have your own band, Missy Raines and the New Hip, Helen Highwater String Band. You have done a number of things. Can you kind of talk to us about some of your bands that you've played in and talk to us about what you're currently doing? I know the pandemic has affected things greatly in the last year or so. So kind of talk to us about your current band projects or playing projects period these days with the pandemic.
Yeah, well, certainly the pandemic has changed the landscape for all of us right now, but we're sort of slowly going back into, being able to play. Yeah, I've played with all those folks, and I did have a band called The New Hip. I still have a band, but these days, I don't call it The New Hip. It's sort of, I decided that The New Hip was a band that sounded a certain way and, was fairly contemporary. And as you mentioned before, a little jazz inspired. But these days, I'm doing more of a bluegrass approach. So I'm carrying, you know, fiddle, mandolin, and guitar, and bass, and sometimes banjo. Fiddle is I've never actually, you know, hadn't traveled much toured with a fiddle player until recently. So, I'm working on a new album, which I hope will be out in 2022 early. And it's going to be, you know, just all sort of my version of bluegrass. And so that's what I'm doing these days. And I actually have, the name of the band is sort of something I'm getting ready to announce pretty soon, but I can't quite announce it yet.
Okay.
So I'm traveling. Well, I will be traveling and with this little bluegrass ensemble that I was talking about, and working on a new record. And one of the main things that I've been doing during this pandemic is trying to write songs, and have had some success with that. And sort of I've written a lot of really bad songs, and I've written a few decent ones, and I'm looking forward to gathering them together and recording them on this record. But I'm one of those people that I always like. I'm surrounded by such fantastic writers, and I know some of my favorite writers are happen to be some of my greatest friends. So I'm also picking and choosing a few other songs that I have access to record, and maybe trying to dig up one or two of some classics maybe to record. Still working on exactly what it is will be on this album, but it's really, really been fun to think about that. So that's what I've been spending most of my pandemic time doing. And that is after the first couple of months, like a year ago, when it all first happened. I will be honest, I was, you know, not playing music. I was a bit depressed about the whole situation. I was very scared. I was very nervous about what was happening, just like many people. And I came home off the road on March 13th, literally like that day, and I haven't been anywhere since. And, I kind of just retreated to my yard, and, you know, I'm a very, you know, sort of an avid gardener. And so I just went out in my yard and started digging up weeds and planting things and clearing out brush, and did that for a couple of months till I sort of cleared my head enough to where I could come back inside, so to speak, and start writing. And one of the first songs that I wrote was called Digging Up the Weeds.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to talk to you some more about your songwriting, too. Now, in 2020, you were a co-writer with the IBMA Song of the Year. You won that award last year, and you were a co-writer with Becky Buller and Allison Brown for Chicago mm-hmm. Barn Dance, which was a song for the Special Consensus.
Yeah. That was just such a great opportunity. We basically, you know, there's many ways that you can have be inspired to write a song, of course. But one of the ways is like someone can say, hey, I need a song that talks about this or that. And this was the case where you know, Allison, who was producing the Special Consensus, their album, and it had this Chicago theme, and she suggested to Becky and I that we write something about the Chicago Barn Dance. And so we, you know, it was like a project, like a school project or something. So, but it was so much fun, and we wrote that, and then of course Allison joined in and you know, created a really cool instrumental section to go with the song. So it was just a really big collaborative event. You know, Becky's just one of, she's just a powerhouse. She's one of those people that really affecting change within the bluegrass world. As she, you know, she's just doing it in every way, right? Songwriting, singing, fiddle playing, you know, leading up her band. And so I always enjoy getting to write with her.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you try to write something every day or so much every week? Or how do you go about your songwriting?
I do. Well, these days I do. I try to write every day. You know, that's sort of always the goal. That's the, you know, I have a few items that I need to do every day, and that's one of them. But, you know, I'll be honest with you, before the pandemic, I didn't get to write every day. I would be lucky if I got to write, I don't know, a couple of times a month or even once a month because of my touring schedule. And because, honestly, I felt like pre-pandemic times, my priorities were just kind of all out of whack. And, you know, I was thinking that XYZ was really super important, and some of that probably was, but now that I've had this time at home and been able to really focus on some things that matter and been able to sort of look at things from a very quiet space, headspace, I'm realizing, you know, sort of realigning some priorities. And so I'm hoping that once I get back out to touring that I can still maintain, you know, attention to the things that are the most important to me. And that's one of the gifts that this time has given to those of us who are fortunate enough to still be standing at the end of this. And I don't take that lightly. I know that so many people have suffered, and it's not been easy for us either, but many people have suffered so much more.
Yeah, like you say, that's a thought. You know, I've heard a lot of people say that as bad as it's been, I guess the good thing or silver lining is pandemic has kind of been a chance to reset, if you will, for a lot of people and realign their priorities. So that's a good thing, I guess, that's come out of it.
Well, it really is. And the trick will be, like I said, to how we function when we get back out in there into the world, not just within our own daily routines and our own self-care, but how we treat each other in the world. And I think that's really important. And it's going to be, I think that sometimes I think that the reason this is dragging out as long as it is has also given us that extra gift of truly making some real changes within ourselves, you know, in whatever areas we feel we might need to. It would have been, like, if this had only lasted just a couple of months, I never would have gotten to the headspace that I am right now. And I wouldn't even have seen that a year ago. I would have thought, I would, if it had only lasted 2 or 3 months, I would have thought that would have been this huge lesson. But now I realize that it's through the actual almost agony of a year, over a year now, of absolutely being disconnected from the world that I knew, that it has forced me to really sort of see things a little differently, treat my life and what I make clear what it is that I want to do with the rest of my life. So all of those things that I'm very grateful for.
With the pandemic, have you switched the way you interact with people, I guess, like so many artists have? Are you doing more of an online presence?
You know, I have been. I've done a lot of workshops. I've done a lot of interviews and sort of Zoom talks and panels and that sort of thing. And a few, but I haven't done a lot of online playing, to be honest with you. And for one thing, I haven't been able to get together with my band safely, only but a few times when we could play outside. But now that's starting to change, and we did a live stream concert last weekend, and we're starting to rehearse again for the album over. So that's all changing, and I've got more workshops coming, and I've got more online streaming that I'm going to be doing this year, even though by the end of the year, I'll likely actually be out, you know, playing live in person. I'm actually working on building up that online presence as well.
Well, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about recording. You have had a relationship with Compass Records for a while now. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah. Compass Records has, you know, given me so many great opportunities. Of course, I've known Alison Brown, she and I go way back to the, you know, to the mid-80s, pretty much when she first came to Nashville, when she was still playing with Alison Krauss. And so I've done three records with them so far, on my own, of course, lots of other things with other people. Alison produced the last record that I did, Royal Traveler, which got nominated for a Grammy, for a Bluegrass Grammy. And so it's just been a really great relationship working with the whole Compass team, and especially just working with Alison, because she's just, she really has a way of looking at things from 30,000 feet, you know, and just being able to see the big picture and still take care of the detail as well.
Well, speaking of recording, we talked a little bit earlier. You mentioned you had a studio there, and I wanted to ask you about recording your bass. Do you have a specific setup that you like to use? Do you have your own microphones you tag along with you, or do you kind of depend on the engineer, or what's your setup when you go into the studio?
One of the mic that I use predominantly when I'm playing live is an ear trumpet mic called the Nadine. And I also have a full circle Fisherman pickup on my bass that I use the combination of those two often on live on stage. But when I'm in the studio now, my husband is a recording engineer, and his name is Ben Surratt, and he's done a lot of great records and got a lot of recognition and won a lot of awards for his recording work with a lot of different musicians. Mm-hmm. Through the years. So when I think it was 2013 that we moved into the house we are now, we bought it specifically because it had a basement that was the appropriate to build a studio.
Yeah.
that's how musicians like pick out their homes.
Yeah.
You know? It turns out we were very lucky because the living space was also, you know, very nice and wonderful. But the basement was perfect for us to build the studio. We had a dream to do that, and so we did. So I do a lot of recording there, obviously. But if you asked about mics in the studio, and of course I'm going to sound like an idiot because I can't tell you which mic he uses typically for me. I should know by heart, but that's the thing when you have an engineer for a husband, you just don't have to worry about these things. Because he just has my back, and he knows how, he's a great engineer, but he also really knows how to get the sound from my bass. And he uses two mics, I can tell you that, and I'm just going to sound like just a complete idiot because I'm like blanking on the mics that he uses.
That's fine. Do you record into Pro Tools?
Yeah, he uses Pro Tools. Although he has recorded a lot of stuff analog. Because he started as an engineer before Pro Tools really took off, and so he learned his craft by through analog. But we don't do much analog recording down in the studio. So these days, I mean, analog is just for the average musician, it's just a whole lot more expensive to record that way. But yeah, we're running most things through Pro Tools. I've done a lot of recording myself also on analog, but it's been a while.
Yeah. How do you feel the sound is between analog and digital?
You know, that's interesting you ask, because I think you mentioned earlier, I was in a duo. I had a duo with Jim Hirsch, the great guitarist and singer and songwriter. And Jim and I, we met when we were both playing for Claire Lynch. And then when Claire got off the road, one of the times that she got off the road, we decided to have this duo. So we did this duo and we recorded a couple of records. During that time, again, this was all before Pro Tools, so we were in the studio and we did an A-B test of miking the guitar and the bass. It wasn't before Pro Tools, but Pro Tools wasn't as predominant as it is now. So we did an A-B and between the two, digital and analog. And I can tell you that we all came to the same conclusion, and that was that the guitar sounded pretty much the same in both ways, but the bass definitely did sound warmer in analog. But we ended up going with digital because we could afford it better.
Right.
And because, like, I think if both instruments had won the analog battle, then we probably would have just gone ahead with the analog and come up with the money. But since it was only one of them, at that point in time and that day in the studio, the bass definitely felt warmer on analog. But I'm not sure that test would stand up today. I mean, I'm literally talking about this would have been, 20 years ago. So there's a lot of things that are better now. There's a lot of gear that's in between the instrument and Pro Tools that's going to make it better now. So
yeah,
and they're better mics or they're different mics that we perfected and that sort of thing. So it's hard to say. It would be fun to do another A-B test.
Yeah. Does your husband still have an analog machine too?
Yeah, he does. He has one. It's not really up and running at the moment, but he's working on getting that so it can be an option in the studio. And so he's working on that.
You're listening to Acoustic Music Talk with your host, Brad Apple.
You mentioned gardening. What kind of other hobbies Missy Raines enjoys when you're not immersed in music? What do you like doing?
Well, yeah, I do. I do love gardening. I love planting flowers and arranging and building new flower beds and that sort of thing. I like to cook, and so I have fun doing that. I like to go to yard sales.
Yeah.
That is one of my most favorite things to do, is to hop in the car on a weekend. And again, it used to be every now and then I'd have a free weekend and be at home, and it would be like a vacation to get to go out on a Saturday and check out some yard sales. But now it's like I have every weekend off, so it's still fun. I like to hike in the woods, but I like to hike in the woods in the wintertime more than I do in the summertime, which is odd, I know, but I really like to hike in the winter. And something about just being able to see the branches instead of the leaves. I like that.
Right. Well, I was thinking that too, in the woods, summertime, you got ticks and chiggers and snakes.
Snakes.
Yeah.
Snakes are a big part of this. I since you brought it up, I'll admit that's a big part of it. But there is, I do find a lot of the beauty of the branches and things that are the quietness of the wintertime. I like just spending time in small groups of people, like small circles of friends and my family. I love being at the ocean. I love the ocean so much, and I'm also very particular. I really like the Atlantic Ocean, the mid-Atlantic section kind of that I'm most familiar with. That's the most nostalgic for me.
Yeah.
Say from about North Carolina north, and any part of that coastline is really special to me. So I like being near it. I like swimming in it, like smelling it, looking at it. So, and then of course I have cats. I'm kind of known for being a little bit of the crazy cat lady. I love dogs too, but I just don't have one because our schedule is a little crazy to keep one. Of course, this last year would have been different, but.
Yeah. What's one of your favorite meals?
Like really great vegetables made really well and a perfectly grilled piece of salmon and a really great glass of wine and some good bread or something. I don't know. That's just one of my favorite meals.
We would like to thank Missy Raines once again for joining us on the Acoustic Music Talk podcast. We invite you back next time when we will be interviewing another great in the world of acoustic music. Until then, stay safe and we'll see you back here.
Thank you for listening to Acoustic Music Talk. Join us again next week for another episode as we continue to explore the world of acoustic music.